Welcome to the LGBTQIA+ Atastica Graphics Digital Symposium podcast series. We hope you enjoy the series. If you have any comments or questions, drop us a line on our Discord server and join us for the roundtable discussion of the series on November 20th, 2021 via Zoom. For details, go to fantasticajournal.com and select the upcoming events heading. That's Fantastica with a K. Details are in the podcast info. The discussions are free and open to all, but registration is required for each Zoom panel. There are 5 panels in total.
This podcast is part of Panel 3, Interrogating Space and Place. The Zoom discussion will take place on November the 20th at 3 p.m. GMT time. This podcast is presented by Emma French, who is currently studying for a PhD in Fantasy Literature at the University of Glasgow. Her thesis examines how Dungeons & Dragons consolidates notions of fantasy, while also giving players agency to subvert genre convention. She is a member of the Glasgow International Fantasy Conversations Committee and an editor at Mapping the Impossible Journal for Fantasy Research. Her podcast today is entitled Detoxifying Male Fantasy, Genre Savviness and Desire in the Worldbuilding of Die.
Hello and welcome to Detoxifying Male Fantasy, Genre Savviness and Desire in the Worldbuilding of Die. Today I will discuss how the comic book Die represents a queer negotiation of traditionally cis and heteronormative fantasy genre culture, represented here through the microcosm of the tabletop role-playing game, or TRPG. Die, by Kieran Gillen, Stephanie Hans and Clayton Cowles, has been essentially blurbed as Gloth Jumanji. The series follows a group of adults who are forcibly sucked into the world of the TRPG their friend Sol wrote for them as children. The adventuring party, led by Dominic Ash, must try to find a way to survive and escape back into the real world. Before I begin, I would like to clarify something. This talk focuses primarily on Ash, the narrator and protagonist, who presents as male and straight in the real world, but conducts relationships with all genders and inhabits a feminine body capable of getting pregnant within Die itself. At the point of submitting my abstract, my plan was to primarily focus on their queerness in terms of their bisexuality and not their gender identity. This is mostly in the interest of staying in my own lane as a cisgender woman and not making any incorrect assumptions about the text. With the release of the final volume of Die and the insight Ash gave into their own queerness, I didn't feel like this distinction could meaningfully hold up. For Ash, fantasies of desire are multifaceted, which is fitting for a comic about TRPGs. It is not just about who you love, but who you want to be while you're expressing that. As I was writing this talk, I found that there were some clear intersections between Ash's gender identity and their sexuality, and as in real life, it became harder and harder to separate the two, even before the final volume applied the label of gender fluidity to their character. Separating the two for the sake of my own comfort was proving vastly unproductive. Therefore, this talk is now about Ash's queerness, used here as an umbrella term. With that clarified, let me begin. Although queer communities have always existed within fantasy fiction and TRPG fandom, I don't think it's controversial to claim that, until very recently, it was often considered the province of cis, heterosexual, white men. Die is tellingly not a snapshot of contemporary fantasy genre culture, a term coined by Helen Young to describe the textual, social, and cultural practices of all participants in a genre, including readers and fans. Die is instead an encapsulation of a history, a fantasy canon, defined by Gillen by way of John Peterson's book, Playing at the World. As an imaginary secondary world in which the characters are forced to live, the world of Die literalizes the practice of roleplay. But it also literalizes fantasy's genre history, tracing immersion in imaginary worlds from the Brontes, through H.G. Wells and Tolkien, up to D&D and video games. The party encounters this history physically, with each author represented as a country existing on the facets of a 20-sided planet. The ability of TRPGs to embody a genre culture is not unique to Gillen's use of them here. When TRPGs such as Dungeons & Dragons attempt to encompass a genre within its rulebooks, they catalogue and to some extent secure the predominant trends of that genre culture. According to Ryan Vu, TRPGs present genre as structure, boiled down to its essence, and this in turn creates a set of tools for analysing those typical structures. As the sentient voice of Die says in the final volume, game mechanics are simply conventions given shape. Am I mad that Gillen condensed my entire thesis down to 3 words? Absolutely. But the way that TRPGs condense a genre's textual practice down is also useful for exposing other structures of power at work within that subculture. A D&D handbook presents a set of assumptions about what the stereotypical reader expects from a fantasy text. Then, in the hands of the players and the GMs, the actual reader gets the opportunity to challenge or subvert these expectations. In the opening volume of Die, Fantasy Heartbreaker, the notion of expectations is explicitly discussed. The teenage adventuring party have the following exchange. You have no idea how good this will be. This is fantasy for grown-ups. And with that we were sold, because we were deluded enough to think that's what we actually wanted. Sol promises his players a mature adult fantasy campaign, placing Die in the grimdark fantasy genre, a hyper-masculine mode that typically relies on uncritical replications of patriarchy and is associated with male authors such as George R. R. Martin, Joe Abercrombie, and Peter V. Brett. Again, I don't think it's particularly controversial to state that this subgenre, up until very recently, was typically hostile to women, queer people, and people of colour. This hyper-masculine mode of fantasy is reflected in nearly all the facets of Die. The world that Ash and their friends travel through is a male-dominated one continually at war, continually enacting violence on itself. This performs grimdark genre convention, while also reflecting the dominant mode by which TRPGs also structure themselves, which is combat. But this is not just a commentary on modern fantasy. When Ash finds themselves in the trenches of Tolkien's facet, it too is a perpetual war zone in which not a single woman is present. Similarly, in their encounter with H.G. Wells, they face extreme misogyny and patronisation while inhabiting their feminine body, being constantly talked down to as a very intelligent type of girl. Both authors lament Die's violence, reflecting their pacifism in real life, but they cannot seem to stop themselves enacting it. They continue to engage in Die's war, and also relegate non-white, non-male voices into the corners of the text. This trend is present way before the party even meets H.P. Lovecraft, the final author figure they must confront before they can reach the heart of Die. Lovecraft is, rather tellingly, killed by the character Izzy, a woman of colour, in order for the plot of fantasy to, and its rescue, to meaningfully progress. If the predominant image of fantasy that Die presents is male, white and straight, Ash, on the surface, seems to conform to this. In a line that recurs throughout the series, accumulating nuance, Sol begins Volume 1 stating that Die is in fact for Ash, a gift designed for their 16th birthday, a world that was crafted with them in mind. But the surface reading of this line and the assumption it makes about Ash's identity quickly breaks down once they actually negotiate the fantasy genre culture which Die encapsulates. Within Die, Dominic becomes Ash, a female-faced character called a dictator, who can use their voice to ensnare and control those around them. I found that Ash's dictator powers are intrinsically tied to their queerness. Their agential manipulation of thought and desire for their own benefit plays into some negative assumptions prominent in representations of bisexual people within media. In 2015, GLAAD noted that the depraved bisexual trope had become a prominent aspect of bisexuality's visibility in fiction. Bisexual characters are depicted as untrustworthy, prone to infidelity, and/or lacking a sense of morality, often using sex as a means of manipulation and lacking the ability to form genuine relationships. If we look at this trope in relation to Ash, we see that the notion of amorality and manipulation is particularly prominent. As a dictator, they can reshape the world around them through their speech, and thus every relationship they have can be accused of being insincere. In an off-page argument described as everything phobic by Ash, Izzy even accuses them of seducing her partner using their voice, playing into these associations with infidelity. But Gillen is himself a bisexual man, so it doesn't make sense for such stereotypes to be replicated here uncritically. While manipulation and promiscuity are negative tropes associated with bisexual characters, it is true that Ash's voice is a kind of seduction. While their friend Chuck encompasses seduction in the reductive, objectifying, "I roll to seduce X" sense, Ash seduces for political power. In their takeover of kingdoms, they achieve their goals through manipulating the desires of leaders and government officials, typically men. In a prominent example, when they annex the kingdom of Angria, they demand that its own dictators will love me without limit, and they then take control of Angria's leader through the oath, "Zamorna the Unhumbled, be my humble servant," which results in a diplomatic marriage. This conquest by seduction goes hand in hand with their beautiful, hyper-feminine presentation, and so becomes overlaid with anxieties surrounding transgressive, queer femininity, or that which exists outside of patriarchal structures. Ash's voice places them in a liminal space where they become both the subject and object of desire. They exist as a sexual object, but they then force the world around them to accept the authorities of their own desires, their relationships, and their presentation, through the absolute agency that this voice gives them. Although threatening, This agency is in direct opposition to the hypermasculine violence that other authors in the world must resort to. I find it interesting that Ash fosters their seat of power within Angria, formerly the imaginary world of the Brontes, and the only female-authored fantasy country encountered within the comic. Yes, Ash is a hypersexualized, manipulative bisexual, but their weaponized queerness provides the only meaningful counter-narrative to the war, violence, death, and destruction of the hypermasculine mode that surrounds them on all sides. Dai's final volume, Bleed, does a great deal to explain how Ash's queerness is both the source of their power and their anxieties, particularly around autonomy and authority. As they and their party descend through the final dungeon of Dai, they come against what is, from our clear literacy as fantasy readers, a monster, a dragon. Hiding deep in undelved depths, wreathed in flame, the party confront a massive fiery serpent, one that wears the face of Ash herself, the woman that Dominic Ash is in this world. This image is steeped in the meaning it accumulates through the fantasy genre culture it references. The serpent has clear links to subversive or destructive femininity, but the dragon also lies in an established nexus of meaning provided by genre culture. With very few cues, we can understand what the image is trying to convey. Dragons are powerful. They are also accumulators of power. They're hoarders. They're also embodiments of desire. As Tolkien famously said, "I desired dragons with a profound desire." Ash sees their queer self as threatening, but also crucially as greedy. It's too much to want more than what you've been told you're allowed to have. To be loved without limit, a line which the dragon repeats here, is a threat and not a blessing. What follows is a scene in which Ash essentially comes out to their friends. While Ash ends up landing on the label of gender fluidity, the confrontation also does a lot to explain why the other facet of their queerness, their bisexuality, has been represented here in such a negative, weaponized and mercenary light. They say, "You've seen how I've acted here, to all of you. I feel like I could do anything." Their queerness is a power fantasy, but it's one that's operating within the boundaries of the fantasy they inhabit, which is this masculine, heteronormative mode. Breaking its boundaries somehow feels too transgressive. The idea of limits recurs as they realise that they can essentially break through genre and thus the power structures that genre is replicating. It makes them too powerful because it goes beyond the realms of the imagination they inhabit into new realms of overwhelming possibility. In the sequence that follows, Ash gets a pep talk from the other queer women in the party. They then go down into the dungeon, grapple with their fiery serpentine queerness, and tug it over the edge of a precipice into unfathomable darkness. The intertextualities at play here do not even attempt to be subtle, with the words "fly you fools" even quoted directly. Which means that a few pages later, we do all expect it when, having struggled with and accepted their boundary-breaking queerness, Ash returns, transformed and entirely clad in white. Again, this is a narrative moment that is figured entirely through trope. We understand the meaning and it has impact because of the intertextualities it invokes from fantasy genre culture. In turn, queerness offers the trope's new life and new impact, turning nostalgia into something new. Sol's repeated line, "I may die for you," becomes, "I wanted you to find yourself, Ash. I wanted you to find you." Ash's queer subjectivity breaks Dai and then remakes it. Fantasy is a tool designed to give voice to desire, but it can only do so sufficiently once the current limits of that genre are broken. I also found it interesting that when the label gender fluidity is offered to Ash, it is by one of his friends, who only knows it because she's a schoolteacher. The label has been provided by the future generation, the people who are now consuming fantasy, who are playing role-playing games and participating in fandom, creating new things, rather than venerating the past in the way that Dai does. In a slightly clunky line, Ash's internal monologue states, "We didn't have the words for any of these complexities then, and since then there's been all these expansion packs about character classes." I couldn't help but wonder if the use of jargon here was partly an allusion to how D&D has only just begun to hastily unpick some of the more unfortunate implications encoded into its rules. These implications are only coming to light as the subculture modernizes, becoming visibly broader and more diverse. In the final volume of this comic, there is a call to move out of the era of fantasy that Dai enshrines and into a new one. When Chuck, the famous white, straight, male fantasy author and misogynist, is the only main character to actually die, you have to wonder how subtle Gillen is actually trying to be about this message. So, to conclude, Dai's worldbuilding literally reflects how TRPGs can function as microcosms of the wider genres they reflect. In this case, it also exposes the heteronormative, patriarchal power structures that have historically underpinned fantasy. As a presumed male reader of fantasy who does not fit the dominant mode because of their queerness, Dominic Ash struggles with negotiating this condensed version of fantasy. A character like Chuck, performing a hypermasculine power fantasy, fares a lot better, literally living a charmed life and avoiding many of the consequences, because he more easily fits into the gender roles provided by the genre's mainstream. Ash finds it easiest to exist in Angria, a desire-driven and feminine mode of fantasy steeped in the Gothic. They derive their agency from dictatorship, a less violent but also more hypersexual mode of authorizing the world around them, and they suffer anxiety from experiencing a life without limit. What exactly could they be capable of when they let themselves be themselves, without shame and without repentance? They contend not only with the demonization of transgressive queer femininity, but also the concept of the manipulative bisexual, thought to be ensnaring and manipulating everyone in reach. Yet this is also factually accurate. Their polysemous, disruptive manipulation of desire is precisely where they get their power, as a character and as a narrator and author within Die itself. In the closing pages of Die, Ash says, "You were perhaps hoping we'd defeat Die. How can you defeat something like that? All you can do is make peace with it, and the peace you make with it is your own." The queer subjectivity presented in Die cannot erase fantasy's past, but it can take that history and the building blocks of meaning it represents and look towards the future with the hope of either remaking or building something new.
We hope you enjoyed this discussion of the graphic novel Die. This podcast series continues with Panel 4 on intersectional approaches, with Marietta Cosma, who will be discussing Octavia Butler's Kindred and how Dana's positioning as a queer subject is informed by race and disability.
If you enjoyed this series or have questions, join the conversation with us on Discord and on November 20th, 2021 for our Zoom webinars. For details, go to fantasticajournal.com and select the upcoming events heading. The discussions are free and open to all, but registration is required for each of the 5 Zoom panels. We look forward to seeing you there.